Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints. And man, we have a great show for you today. And the great part is, it's not snowing anymore. The sun is shining. Yay! Which is really a good thing because I haven't seen it for a while. So we're going to talk to Brian Freeman in just a minute. I'm going to talk about Homicide Detective Frost Eaton. He's really a cool character. He doesn't like coincidences, and neither do I. When a series of bizarre deaths rock San Francisco, deals with a psychiatrist named Francesca Stein, whose controversial therapy methods are quite interesting. So good morning, Brian. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing great. The sun is shining here, too.
This is great because it's going to snow tomorrow, they said, or something. I just try to ignore the weather.
we had
a couple of inches the other day that we weren't expecting. So how rude is the weatherman? So would you tell us, give our listeners just a brief summary of this one, and then we can start talking about Frankie Stein. She's interesting.
Yes, and you have to love that name too, Frankie Stein. I had a lot of fun with that. So.
Yes, the Nightbird
is my newest thriller. It's really all new for me because new character with Frost Eaton and a new setting in San Francisco, which readers have been loving. That's great. And the whole book revolves around the idea of memory and how your memories can be manipulated, and so it gives. It gives us the opportunity for some very scary, creepy scenes, and Inspector Frost Eaton has to track down a killer who can somehow turn memories into a murder weapon.
That's even scarier, because I just read one about lucid dreams and how they can affect your life too. So that's interesting too. This is great. So tell us about Frankie and her crazy method of dealing with memory things, because that's scary and it led to kind of scary stuff too.
Yeah, the character who shares the stage with Frost in this book is a San Francisco psychiatrist named Francesca Stein, and she has a very controversial therapy practice. She deals with patients who have gone through, severe traumas and have severe fears and phobias. And the way she deals with them is by trying to erase or replace the patient's most terrifying memories so that the original phobia is sort of gone and replaced by something more secure. But of course, it's a very controversial practice, and a lot of other people in her profession think that this is unethical and that she shouldn't be doing this. And suddenly she begins to find that her therapy methods seem to be being turned against her because problems start to happen with her patients.
Then this is scary because these people have phobias. Like I don't like heights. Forget it. So
yeah, same with me. Exactly.
Yeah. I hate that. I hate that. I have to take something.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I think everybody's got things like that. I mean, they're just little things that seem irrational, and you look around and you think that, well, nobody else seems to have this problem but me. But the fact is, there are lots of people that have phobias about different things, and heights and bridges are two of the big ones. Mm. And in fact, there's an actual name for a fear of bridges. It's gephyrophobia, and there's a character in The Nightbird who suffers from that. And in fact, you meet her in the very first chapter of the book when she is stuck in a traffic jam on top the San Francisco to Oakland Bay Bridge. And that is a place that poor Lucy does not like to be stuck because she absolutely hates bridges. And she's very much like me in that regard. I find it almost impossible to drive over a bridge because they just freak me out so much. And Lucy's the same way. So there she is stuck up on top of the Bay Bridge with nowhere to go and no way to get out. And she's starting to panic. And the only person who's there to kind of try to keep her calm is her friend Bryn. And Bryn doesn't have any kind of fear of bridges. She's perfectly happy up there, except then something go wrong.
Yeah, something scary when goes wrong, and poor Bryn. That's scary because when you have a phobia, sometimes it takes over your life. So how do you live a normal life if you're afraid of everything? I mean, I know there's people that are afraid to go outside. There are people that are afraid of cats. There are people that are afraid to be alone. There are people that are afraid of everything. That's scary.
Yeah, and the thing is, people will go to exceptional distances to sort of get around their phobias. One of the examples that Dr. Stein gives in the book is of someone that had a fear of railroad tracks and would routinely go miles out of his way in order to try to find a route that did not have to take him directly across railroad tracks. And people do those kinds of things. People that have fear of bridges will go miles out of their way to avoid a bridge. I'm guilty of doing that up in Duluth. They have a couple really mean bridges up in the Duluth area, and there are days where I'll travel 10 miles south to be able to cut across on a tiny little railway bridge rather than having to take the high bridge across from Duluth to Superior.
Well, I don't blame her. I had a friend, I would miss her. She wouldn't take the highway to work, and it would cost her like another 20, 30 minutes just to come down. Instead of coming down the parkway, she took all the back roads. And
right.
She said
yep.
It was better for her. Yeah, a lot of people don't like highways because they're afraid of getting on and getting off. It's scary.
Yep.
Oh, God.
Yeah, my mom hated taking the freeways. She would do anything to avoid that. So we're all just masses of insecurities out there.
I know. So somebody is creeping into these people's brains, and they cause them to do horrible things. And when these suggestions go haywire and the patient doesn't know what to do, it's like a sci-fi movie right out of Alfred Hitchcock. It's scary.
A little bit, yeah. This book has some Hitchcock elements to it, very, very deliberately. I mean, even the San Francisco setting has. Sort of echoes of Vertigo in there, and I think Hitchcock fans will enjoy The Nightbird because there are some little creepy Hitchcock elements in there. Sitting up on the bridge, Lucy and Bryn are there, and Lucy is, as I say, starting to freak out, and she looks. She looks behind her at some of the other cars that are stuck up on the bridge with her and glances over and in this beat up old Cutlass a couple cars away, suddenly the window rolls down and she sees a man inside the other car, but it doesn't seem to be a man. He's wearing he's wearing this extraordinarily creepy mask with this wild smile and sort of these fly chambered eyes and by the time she alerts Bryn to this, the window is closed again. And so Lucy's wondering, did I really see that? So those are some of the scary little things that get you started in The Nightbird.
It's almost like they're gaslighting people. Like he's gaslighting them. Like, I see you, but it's not really there. I'm going to drive you crazy, but you're not going to know why. Oh, my God, that was a scary movie. I'll tell you that. I know, and I'm like, oh, my God. I used to watch Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and my mother would say to me, what are you watching? And I never watched much television, but it was so interesting to watch that. And I said, well, someday, maybe, more, I'll write like that. And that's not going to happen. There's only one Alfred Hitchcock, but you never know. But this book lends itself to, So tell our listeners the significance of the music. The music in the person's head controls the events. And I'm a music person, and I like the other day I wanted to play something, and I go like, wait a minute, maybe I better not, because I'm going to talk about Nightbird, and I don't want the guy to get in my head. Mush up there.
That's the thing. Music has a very, very powerful effect on the brain, and music is a big part of memory. I mean, in the same way that they say that smells can elicit very powerful memories. Music can do the same thing, and so in The Nightbird, music seems to be at the heart of how these women are being controlled, and so they can be perfectly fine one moment, and then a certain song comes on the radio, and bad things start to happen. I won't mention which particular song it is, I was driving in the car yesterday, and of all things, that was the song that came on the radio, and
oh wow!
I had to hold on to the wheel particularly tightly just to make sure nothing bad happened.
I know, and I looked up the words to the song. And I was my God, And I know, I said, oh, wow, this is really scary. I wonder how she would feel if she knows that people are getting dead because they're listening to her song. Oh, my God.
Yes, I kind of wonder, am I going to be getting an email from her? So.
No, well, you know what? If enough people read the book, you never know, they're going to put it in the review, probably.
That's true. Well, we had such a, you know, the official date of the release of the book was just yesterday, February 1. So now it's out in you know, Kindle and hardback and paperback and audio, so people can get it in any format they want. But for all of January, The Nightbird was actually available on a special promotion through Amazon called their Kindle First program. So Amazon Prime members were able to get a special deal on The Nightbird throughout January. And that was really amazing because it meant that the book spent almost the entire month at number one on the Kindle bestseller list. And we got more than 1,400 reviews for the book in less than a month. So that was just amazing.
I saw, and I went to put my review on, and I got really upset because I said, look at all these people, and my review's so much better. Seriously. Because I actually read the book. I'm finding that a lot of people are just, you know, reading the cover or reading the blurb, and they're not reading the book, and then they don't quite get it, and I go like, mine's better. I have a lot more to say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you got
without giving anything away.
Yeah.
I sure did. I said, what a nice present in the mail. And I'm sitting there with like 70 books, and I go like, wait a minute, Brian Freeman, okay, this everybody else can wait. It was the same thing with last week. 2 weeks ago, I finished, I took my time because it was like a million pages, The Lost Order by Steve Barry. That was really, really good. And
I just had a reader mentioning Steve at my event on Tuesday night, saying how much he enjoyed his books.
Yeah, The Lost Daughter is really great. What would happen if all laws, and this, you know, with what's going on in the news, you never know. What would happen if they changed the law that all legislation would start in the House, and they would decide everything, and then the Senate would have very little power? And that's just one thing that, it's a senator's wife that didn't like the senator anymore, and she figured he wasn't going to go along with her. So it was murder, it was government cover-ups, it was really good, and it's about gold. And it's about the gold hidden away from the Confederate Army, a whole bunch of gold pieces that people are sentinels that are watching over. It was interesting. So we've got Lucy that hates bridges, and we've got Bryn that's afraid of cats.
Yeah. Bryn had a terrible experience with cats growing up, and so she wanted to be able to get past that because her new fiance has cats, and so it seems like a simple kind of problem, and it seems like a safe sort of thing. All she wants to do is just not remember this phobia. But it seems simple, but unfortunately she gets caught in the web of the Nightbird, and the results are very tragic.
Everything with the Nightbird is tragic. So people, you don't want to meet him, you don't want to play the song, you don't want to get in a car on the bridge that you all by yourself. No, you don't want to.
Yes, and you don't want to hear his voice because he's got that wonderful, creepy, high-pitched whisper,
I kept hearing it in my head every single time because it was so vividly done. I said, oh, my God.
I have not had a chance to listen to the audio version yet. My friend Joe Barrett, he's an actor. He's done all of the audio editions of my books all the way back through Immoral in 2005. And I'm sure that he does a wonderful job of creating the Nightbird whisper, so I can't wait to hear how he tackles that.
That should be interesting, because I don't think I should listen to that. Don't get me too scared.
yeah.
I mean, really,
this one's going to be a scary one for audio, I think. Hearing this out loud, it's got to be a pretty creepy one. That's good.
Well, for those people that don't read on Kindle, because I won't read Kindle because I can't read on my computer, and don't want to be smart enough to buy, you know, like Valentine's Day is in 2 weeks, and you can buy a whole bunch of books and put them in the basket with flowers and candy, that would make
me
happy.
That's true.
Forget the candy. I don't eat candy. But the flowers, yeah, that would be cool. So Nightbird is great. And then if you really don't like the person, play the song. That's all. And
then they'll know. Yes, yeah. If there's a CD single in there of a certain song, it's somebody sending you a message.
Exactly, and you can just, you know, forget them. So we've got Monica, and she's another victim. And what are the major recurring nightmares that she has that she's afraid of? Oh my God, this is like a poor thing.
Yes. I mean, that's there are people that have you know, sort of, you know, ordinary phobias and things in their past, and it starts to come back to haunt them, and so that's what really begins to attract Frost Easton's interest in this as a police inspector, because he has this incident with Brynn up on the Bay Bridge. But this is not the first time that he has encountered some strange behavior that results in a tragic death. Just a couple months earlier, there was a woman named Monica Farr who was at a wedding reception and wasn't even supposed to be there. She was invited as a date for one of the groomsmen at the last minute. And yet somehow in the middle of this reception, something happened and again, something bad happened to Monica. And so it's the same kind of strange, unexplained behavior. And so now two incidents in 2 months begins to attract Frost's attention. And the only thing he can find in common between these two women is the fact that they share a therapist. And that, of course, is Dr. Francesca Stein.
So he's interested in her and her work and her patients. So, but yet he has something in his life, too. He has his sister Katie and her death. So how does this intertwine with that?
Yeah, Frost is such an interesting character to develop. I've really enjoyed writing him. I enjoyed, you know, creating him in The Nightbird, and now I'm working right now on a new Frost Easton book that'll be coming out next January. So I've had a lot of time.
Oh, good.
I'm glad
you're bringing him back.
Frost
makes me feel so much better.
Yes. So I really enjoyed getting to know Frost. He's very different from Stride. He's younger.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of got a little bit of that Justin Timberlake vibe going on, I think. He's not attached. He's sort of, you know, relentlessly single and doesn't really look to get involved with relationships. Probably the closest relationship in his life is his cat Shaq, who travels around with him. So Frost is kind of a quirky guy. But he's got a good heart, and he's got a little bit of a tragedy in his own life, because several years earlier he lost his sister to a serial killer in San Francisco, and he was actually the one that found the body out in the back seat of a Chevy Malibu out on Ocean Beach, and that's really what made him into a cop, and sort of that's what sent him in that direction. But he's still haunted by that, and he and his sister were extremely close, and they knew each other really well, and so to lose her, I think, has sort of is always this hole in Frost's life, and so it has a lot of effect on him. And unfortunately for Frost, this person known as the Nightbird makes a point of knowing his enemy, and so he knows. He knows what really triggers Frost as well, and he starts to play on Frost's own fears and his own memories.
That's even scarier, because he gets caught up in the whole thing. So he decides that he's going to focus on Lucy and her problem, but he warns her not to go to Stein, but she goes anyway because she's afraid of Bridges, so that makes it even more difficult. How come she doesn't listen?
Yeah, Lucy's such a sweet character. I really like Lucy, she's young, she's sweet, she's pretty. She doesn't really fit in San Francisco. She kind of feels like everybody else, sort of, you know, glides through the city so easily, and she never quite feels like she has a place there. So she's kind of looking for how does she feel at home in here. And I think Lucy feels like her fear of Bridges is something that's really holding her back in her life. It's kind of a symbol of everything she can't manage to get past. So Lucy really wants to get rid of her fear of Bridges. When Frost is dealing with Dr. Stein, Lucy is intent on talking to Dr. Stein, partly to help with her own fear of Bridges, but also partly because Lucy is attracted to Frost, she thinks that that finding out more about Dr. Stein and how this memory treatment works will help Frost find out what's really going on with these women that have had these terrible events. So yes, Lucy goes to see Dr. Stein, that proves to be an unfortunate choice.
I know, that's, sometimes you really have to listen, people. And exactly. Handle your problems on your own. Or meditate or something.
It's like those horror films, you know, for heaven's sakes, don't go inside the old barn.
but you know they're going to go anyway.
You know they're going to do it anyway, exactly. There'd be no movie and there'd be no novel if people always did the reasonable, rational, practical thing.
I know. The problem is if there's no conflict in a book, that's boring too. And I read like thousands of them, and you know that. It depends on the conflict. So this kind of fear can, you know, overcome you, and then you're wondering, are you ever going to get over it? And I'm wondering if Frankie's patients ever get cured, and that would probably spoil everything if they did.
Well, yeah, and that's the, you know, and that's the issue. I mean, it makes for an interesting makes for an interesting ethical dilemma, because the canon of ethics among psychiatrists and psychologists is that you should never try to erase people's memories. That you can help them deal with their memories, but it's wrong to try to manipulate and change their memories. And that's what makes Dr. Stein so controversial in her field, is that she doesn't believe in that, and she thinks that it should be up to the patient to make their choice about whether they are willing to have their memories manipulated. And the comparison she uses is that, cancer is something that you know grows in the body. It's a tumor, and we would not hesitate to excise a tumor from the body. So if that's the case, why should we not allow the patient the choice to excise a memory that torments them? So it's an interesting ethical question, and the whole issue of memory manipulation is one that I think has a lot of interesting issues, pro and con, and it's really real. I mean, obviously, I'm sort of dramatizing all this to create the, you know, the fear and the suspense behind The Nightbird, but the issue of memories being manipulated is very much at the heart of psychiatry these days. And there's a lot of technical and scientific research being done in terms of how memories can be changed, you know, through electroshock therapy, and they're getting down to the level of how the brain manipulates proteins, and can they, you know, use lasers to zap certain proteins that affect memory. And, you know, going all the way back years earlier, there's a lot of studies about how patients acquired false memories during therapy, and the kind of, you know, legal problems that resulted from patients that remembered instances of abuse that never actually happened. There are people that will remember, you know, people that have committed crimes, and they'll look at a face, and they'll think, yep, that's the person I saw. And you know, later on, it will be shown that they were dead wrong. But, you know, to them, they were absolutely convinced that they remembered seeing that person's face, but it was their memory playing tricks on them.
That's scary. So would they use, like, hypnotism or the power of suggestion to change their memories? So if somebody is really crazy and you did a store a book on a crazy psychiatrist that really wanted to, you know, claim that they were helping you erase your memories but creating ones that would cause you to become a killer, that would be even scarier.
There you go. Exactly. That's the ethical conundrum. It's an extraordinary power, but you have to rely on the idea that whoever is wielding that power is doing it for good, and that there aren't, you know, inadvertent consequences or side effects that can come out of that as well. And one of my favorite chapters in the book is when Frost meets Dr. Stein for the first time, and Frost is rather wary of this whole memory thing, and doesn't really believe that this can work. And so Dr. Stein sort of plays a little trick on him with a video she shows him of a car accident, and even just in the course of their conversation, she begins to manipulate what he remembers of seeing that car accident in the video. So that he understands how actually easy it is for your brain to be fooled into thinking things that aren't true.
That is scary. You often wonder sometimes if you have an operation and you're having the anesthesia, you know, if you're going to wake up and be the same person too. That's scary.
Yeah. Well, you know, strange things can happen. I have a friend. She went in for surgery and came out of surgery with a terrible shellfish allergy. had never been allergic to shellfish any time in her life, but after surgery and anesthesia, she acquired a shellfish illness. Very strange. So the body and the mind are strange things, and you never quite know how things are going to affect you, and so it does pay to be a little on the cautious side.
Yeah, that's probably why every time I get a CAT scan, which is not too often, thank God, I won't take the contrast because there's a dye and I'm allergic to shellfish.
Interesting.
Even when I had the surgery last year, my gallbladder, it didn't like me, but it was gone in like 20 minutes. They said to me, do you want all these difficult medicines? I said, extra strength Tylenol will be just fine. And that's what they gave me, because I wouldn't take anything. They looked at me like I was crazy. And they said, you have to stay home for a couple of days. Yeah, one day I just went out, the next day I didn't sit and feel sorry for myself. I mean, it was a little painful, but you live through it. It was no big deal. But
this
is scary, because now I only answer my cell phone since I read this book. Because the significance of the ringing phone, that scares you. That sets everything off. How did you come up with that? That's brilliant, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's and of course Dr. Stein has her ringtone manipulated as well. Actually, she has another phone slipped into her purse that suddenly begins playing this song for her. So I really enjoyed the idea of looking sort of for unusual triggers and things that ordinary things in your life that suddenly start to behave in different ways. I think that's one of the things that Stephen King always does so well is he's able to manipulate, sort of the ordinary elements of life and turn them into things that are scary. And I think that's something I had a lot of fun with in The Nightbird is taking sort of those ordinary aspects of life and turning them on their head and turning them into much more scary events.
The scary part is that he was able to manipulate it so that he could deal with her ringtone, change everything, and scare the daylights out of everybody, including people that read the book, which is a good thing.
That's the funny thing about, books. People just love kind of the scary, creepy aspects of these things. And I hear so many times from readers that they just really love that little shiver of fear that goes up their spine at different points in the book. So that's fun. And that works for me too. I mean, when I'm writing these things, I mean, it'll certainly have me looking over my shoulder too.
Not only that, but I was reading the book and I don't answer my home phone. I never do, because the only ones that call me are, telemarketers or Walgreens to tell me that something's ready. So it started to ring while I was reading the book, and I go like, I'm not answering that. And I can't see who it is on the caller ID. I said, and maybe the Nightbird's trying to tell me not to finish the book. So I literally didn't. I didn't even wait. I don't even have an answering machine on that because I didn't want to know. So we've got two more patients of hers, Todd Ferris and Darren. Who are they? And why did they go to Frankie? They're really low.
Yes. Well, start with Darren, and Darren is a patient that Dr. Stein had a year earlier, and he's kind of the worst nightmare for a psychiatrist, because he's brilliant, he's manipulative, and he's sort of smarter than everyone else around him, and likes to show it off. For Frankie, she feels like Darren is the one patient that sort of fooled her and was able to manipulate her to his own ends, because Darren is something of a psychopath himself, and he ended up using Dr. Stein and twisting around Dr. Stein's treatment to sort of escape his legal jeopardy. And as soon as all this starts happening with the Nightbird, Dr. Stein's suspicion is that somehow this may go back to this patient that she had, Darren, a year ago. And what Dr. Stein does not really admit to anyone is that there was a little bit of a physical attraction between them as well, and it was something that she resisted and didn't want to have anything happen between them. But she struggled with the idea that this person that she did not particularly like nonetheless had this effect on her. And of course, Frankie is looking back on this, and there seem to be strange holes in her own memory as well. And so there's a part of her, there's a part of her that wonders, did something actually happen between her and Darren that she simply doesn't remember? And so into this comes a another patient that she had from the past, Todd Ferris. And Todd is struggling with what he thinks are dreams or nightmares, where he's witnessing people being tortured and memories being manipulated. And he assumes this is not real, and yet it feels real. And he's finding himself waking up in strange areas around the city, and he can't explain it. And so he goes to Dr. Stein to try to find out, you know, why this is happening to him. This is an area where Dr. Stein begins to wonder if actually Todd is being manipulated and framed by the Nightbird.
That's so scary, because you never know who's going to, I mean, innocent people could get killed, or innocent people can go to jail out of nowhere if they actually, like, believe what they hear. That's even scarier.
Right.
Yeah, it is scary. So Lucy decided that she and Frost are going to be the detectives. And how does this affect Frankie? Because basically she's not supposed to tell him anything. He's not supposed to tell her anything. And no one's supposed to say anything about anything. But yet Lucy,
well,
like you said,
thinks
Frost is cool. He is cool.
I like Frost. He's just I just enjoy him as a character. I think he's I always say that, you know, I've known Stride now for what, about 12 years or so, and he and I have grown up together, and Stride is like an old friend to me. It's kind of fun now meeting a detective at a younger age. Frost is in his mid-30s, and, you know, imagining that there's a lot of twists and turns in his life ahead, and be interesting to see kind of where that all goes. But you know, the whole question of you know, doctor-patient confidentiality is you know, at the heart here, because obviously, you know, ethically, Dr. Stein is bound by her code that she can't reveal anything that's going on inside the patient room. And that actually makes it hard for her to be able to share things with Frost, and for Frost to be able to trust her, because she ends up striking out on her own a little bit, because she wants to find out what's going on, and she can't betray anything that has happened in her therapy room unless she's able to actually, you know, persuade herself and be sure that there is some imminent danger to a patient. So it means that she and Frost are sort of on opposite sides a bit throughout the novel, because Frost wants her to tell him exactly what's going on, and Frankie is keeping a lot of these things close to the chest.
Well, she has to, otherwise she could get sued if somebody wants her to, you know, she says, yeah, that's even more dangerous. So she doesn't win, and then she doesn't win no matter what she does. That's scary. So let's go on to the next one. Where am I? Frankie's got a husband that I don't like. Okay?
Yeah, Jason is he's a bit of an ass, isn't he?
He's horrible, and her sister's worse. God.
Yes. Frankie does not have the greatest family. She's got a husband, Jason, who's brilliant, a scientist like her, and works on, you know, memory issues from the scientific, the chemical side, the pharmaceutical side of things, whereas Frankie deals with it on the therapy side. They're very much alike in some ways, but that doesn't necessarily make for a strong relationship. They don't really have a strong emotional connection. You know, Frankie and Jason are sort of a little bit at odds, and Frankie knows that she's as much to blame for that as Jason is, that she finds it hard to sort of reach out emotionally and go out of her shell. And then Frankie also has her sister, Pam, and that's always been a complicated relationship for her, because Frankie and Pam lost their mother at a young age, so they were raised solely by their father, and their father was, you know, one of these distant, distant emotionless scientist who was certainly not the best person to be raising two young girls, and so it made for sort of a contentious triangle growing up between Frankie and Pam and their father. And Frankie took away from it the idea that nothing that she did could ever satisfy her father, and she always kept working harder and harder to try to get his praise. And Pam, meanwhile, sort of went the other way and deliberately was always acting out and sort of defying her father and doing everything he didn't want her to do, because she wanted to sort of throw it in his face. So And about a year ago or a few months ago, their father died, and that was sort of a traumatic moment for Frankie, because as she recalls it, she and her father were out on this camping trip, and he slipped on the cliff's edge and fell, and yet Frankie keeps going back to that incident in her mind because she feels as if she's missing something.
Something happened and she's not sure what it was. We can't tell anybody because that's not anybody's business. They have to figure it out for themselves or the nightbird's going to get them. Trust me. So they inherited money, and her sister uses it for her habit of drugs and alcohol or whatever else, and yet she lives with Frankie. Why does she let her do that? I would tell her to take a walk someplace off a bridge or something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's so often the way families work, and I think it's actually to Frankie's credit that, ultimately she can't really completely walk away from her sister as much as she wants to, and perhaps as much as she should. When Pam sort of, loses her place to live because of yet another disastrous relationship, Frankie takes her into her home, but that just sort of ratchets up the contention and the dissension between them. So
that's scary. So can someone get well or not get well? Can someone start over again and not wind up on the same path? I mean, let's say
I'd like to think so, and I think that's the point of therapy in general, is the idea of trying to help people come to terms with their past and go in a different direction. Certainly there are lots of success stories out there. And I think that Frankie would point to success stories she had, but all of the things that happen in the book lead her to question whether she's actually been doing more harm than good in some way.
Yeah. Cause she begins to question her methods of what am I doing? And maybe I shouldn't do it
this
way. And then maybe I should be a conventional, therapist. But there are a lot of therapists, from what I understand, because there are people I know that actually go there, whatever, that do hypnosis or drugs or Valium or whatever. And I would never do that. No, not me.
It'd be interesting to be hypnotized. I don't know whether I could be hypnotized or not. I mean, I think people sort of wonder about that. It would be an interesting experience to see, would it work? How does it actually work in your mind? And can you actually sort of, fall into that trance in which you're sort of susceptible to suggestion? But I don't know whether it would work for me or not.
I don't want to find out, because if I had to do something like that to remember something, I would make sure that 10 people that I trust were in the room to make sure that they didn't tell me to do something stupid afterwards.
Right. There you go. Exactly.
I would be afraid. You know what? There are things that everybody chooses to forget or that they can't remember. And it's funny because I was in a car accident when I was 17, and I could visualize it in my head. I could tell exactly what happened, but I couldn't tell you whose fault it was.
Right, right. And that's the thing. People have the impression that their memories are sort of coded into their brains like data on a hard drive, and actually nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, memories are kind of like clay, and every time you pull a memory out, it can be, molded and reshaped while it's out there. And it means that how you remember things can actually evolve over time and in the end actually not bear a whole lot of resemblance to what actually happened.
That's true. I can tell you exactly where I was. I can tell you where I was sitting in the car in the middle, in the back. I could tell you what happened. But when someone yelled, "Watch out," or whatever, one car was coming down, one back road, one of us was going, we were going up, they were coming down, and I couldn't tell you who did it. That's the scary part.
The interesting thing is a lot of people, will remember things and they'll be absolutely convinced that is the way it happened. And then they'll be able to see actual evidence of something and realize that no, that's not the way it happened. And they've simply sort of adapted their memories along the way. I mean, and that's so often the case in, particularly in traumatic circumstances where something happens very unexpectedly and you don't know, and you weren't expecting anything to happen. Those are the hardest things to really be able to accurately remember what went on. You know, it's if you go, I don't know if you've ever been to the Sixth Floor Museum down in Texas, where in Dealey Plaza, where President Kennedy was assassinated. Because Marcia and I went down there a few years, and it was fascinating to be in Dealey Plaza and to see how small the area actually was. But it was so easy to see how in just the space of, you know, a few seconds, suddenly, you know, something traumatic happens, and how easy it would be, particularly over time, as this event gets replayed and replayed and replayed through media and stories and other things, that people, you know, simply lose touch with what actually happened and what was in their memory and what has sort of been implanted in their memories by the passage of time and sort of the constant barrage of things happening in the media.
That is so scary. So then Lucy gets the call. So what happens? And she doesn't realize that it's the call, and she just...
Oh, of course. Of course not. Yeah,
that's
of course
scary.
Not. But yeah. And you know, Lucy is, I think, sort of the... she's the most sympathetic victim in this novel because, you know, I think everybody who reads this novel really likes Lucy. And Frost really likes Lucy. But the hard part is that Frost, in some ways, sees when he sees Lucy, Lucy sort of reminds him of his sister Katie. And so for Frost, it's really not a romantic attraction in the same way. It's you know, he sort of feels like a big brother to her and wants to help her and save her. And so that becomes, you know, a big part of Frost's quest in this book, is to try to make sure nothing bad happens to Lucy.
Yeah, but Lucy thinks he's hot, and probably the rest of the characters, when you bring them back, are going to think that too. So, and maybe you know, somebody else will get attached to him or something. But before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Monday I have a show with Brian Masters, Concrete Smile. It's based on gangs and gang warfare, and it's at 1:00 because I didn't know that he was in Hawaii, and I really wasn't going to ask him to get up in the middle of the night to do the show at 10:00 my time and 5:00 his time. So we're going to do it at 1:00 in the afternoon. On the 13th, believe it or not, I'm going to be up at 8:00 because the author is in Japan. And it's at 10:00 his time, and we're going to talk about Vector. And if he's willing to do it at 10:00, I guess I can get up at 7 and do the show at 8. And then on the 16th, I have a panel show. And Brian, one of these days you have to join the panel shows. Seriously, I've got David Morrell, Andrew Gross, and John Land, and we're going to talk about mood and tone in your writing.
Oh, that's a great panel. Yeah, I love David Morrell's book. He's always been one of my favorites.
Yeah, I just finished Ruler of the Night. It was really good, and I'm sorry that he ended the series of the Thomas De Quincey, because his book lends itself to mood and tone, so it should be interesting. And then the 21st, we've got best-selling author Stephen Manchester, Ashes, two brothers that go on a road trip, and of course they have to sprinkle their father's ashes, and that's all I'll say about that. On the 23rd, I've got an author from Scotland. We're going to talk about Riverman, and I have no idea that should be 10:00. I have no idea when. Yeah, it's like 6 or 7 hours later. 28, we're going to talk about dreams again and lucidity. So that's just February, and there's a lot more coming in March, April, and May. And I've got in May 9th, as soon as I get the book, the creator of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer. That should be interesting, too. But more importantly, we've got to find out when Jonathan Schei is coming back.
Yes, yeah, you know, every time I write a book that is not a Stride novel, I start to get these little panicked emails from readers saying, "Oh, you're not done with Stride,
yeah,
are you?" And so, no, I want to assure people that Stride will be back soon. In fact, Stride will be back very soon. This is a busy year for me because I've got two books in 2017. You know, The Nightbird obviously out right now, and Stride will be back in my new book Marathon. That is due out on May 2nd, and so that is going to be the next Jonathan Stride thriller, and it's probably my most topical and intense Jonathan Stride thriller to date. You know, a lot of times Stride deals with cases that, you know, stretch over long periods of time. So in my last book, Goodbye to the Dead, which actually comes out in paperback next week, Goodbye to the Dead took place over the span of over 9 years, and the mystery sort of rippled through all the years in between. Marathon, by contrast, takes place in a span of 5 days, a very, very intense 5 days for the city of Duluth. And Marathon is a book, as I say, it's a very, very topical book for all of the, you know, the anger and hatred and violence that's going on in the country and around the world today. It was very closely inspired in the beginning by the events of the Boston bombing at the Boston Marathon, because Duluth, like Boston, has a very important marathon that attracts tens of thousands of people from around the world. And so Marathon, the new Stride novel, starts with something similar happening in Duluth that happened in Boston, and then goes off in some very different directions and really deals with the roots of hatred and violence and how social media in particular can sort of spawn paranoia and sort of exaggerate the climate of hatred in an area. So it's a very it's a very intense thriller. I can't wait to get it in people's hands. And of course, Stride is always the voice of reason and wisdom throughout the book. So.
Of course, you have to send it into my hands very soon too. Seriously.
Very soon, yes.
Good, because I have so many books inside, and then I get yours, or I get one or two others, and I go, oh, well, they can wait. I'm terrible. But actually, it's up to you. I mean, I've got one show in May on the 9th. I've got my little calendar up here. One on the 17th, it's a panel show on gangs and gang warfare with Bruce Coffin, Christina Hogue, and Bernard Masters. And I've got The Italian Divide by Alan Topol on the 24th. I could actually do, if your schedule holds, either the second or the third when the book comes out.
Ah, well, we'll have to talk and get something on the calendar. I'll check and see where I'm supposed to be on these dates. I'm sure Quirkus has ideas about where I'm going to be as the book comes out. But
I can't wait
to talk to you about it. Yeah, and I would expect that we would have advanced copies going out to reviewers probably in the next 4 to 6 weeks. So.
I'll look for it on my schedule here. I've had so many books, and what the great part about Brian's books is, and I have to say this because it bothers me, I just received a book that I have to interview the author, and it took me, usually like a 300-page book takes like an hour and a half to read. This took me too long because the font was one font.
Oh, my gosh.
Please don't write a book in one. Yeah, please. And they printed out the book for me, too. I said, please don't send me a book less than 12 or 14 because I can't see it. It hurts my eyes.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Oh my God, it drives me crazy. I can't deal with that. And I literally had to get a magnifying glass to read it. And the book was okay. It wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. And I'm saying, like, why am I being tortured? What did I do wrong? I got one at once that was like, the book was 2x4, literally.
Uh-huh.
The book was 2x4.
Oh my gosh, really?
It was 600 pages, and the font was small. And I go, like, but the book was good. It was excellent. I just, like, I don't want to do this again. It's horrible.
Yeah, exactly. I certainly noticed going into my 50s that my eyes don't work quite the way they used to. It's very annoying.
And I gave up figuring out how old I am. I went to the surgeon the other day, and he said, you know, you really shouldn't get your wisdom tooth pulled because it's not bad. I go, in that case, I'll keep it, and, you know, Elvira could stay in my mouth. And then he says, well, at your age, I said, don't ever pull the age card on me because I will not deal with that. He said, you know, your age. I said, I don't even know how old I am. I go, blah, 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 blah. And I was like deaf. He said, well, you know, it takes longer to heal. I go, tell that to the fact that I had surgery 2 years ago, whatever, and not a big deal. So I said, you know what? It doesn't take people longer. It's just a mindset. So
yeah,
I'm just hoping
that those are the three words you really don't want to hear from a doctor is at your age. Yeah.
Yeah. That and, oh, you might have a touch of the A word in your hand. No, I don't. No, my hand bothers me because I type too much. And I have tendonitis. And then the doctor said it could be that A word. I go, maybe you have it, but I don't.
Yeah.
And then they tell you, you know, Fran, it's
you.
Never going to get better. I go, yes, it is. Don't worry about it. I have faith in my hand. Right hand? Yes, it's okay. So before we go, how do you use mood or voice? Whose voices came through in this particular one? We had a panel show last week about voice and point of view. And whose point of view do you think comes out in this book mostly?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the book is told through two perspectives. You see the world through Frost's perspective, and you see the world through Frankie's perspective. You know, and there are a few other little variations of that as you go along. That's you know, a hallmark of most of my novels is that I like to use multi-character perspectives, and I typically don't write in the first person. I've done it in a couple different books, but you know, most of the time I write in the third person, and I write from several different perspectives, and I try to do it in a fairly unique way, which is it's not just you know what that character sees, but it's really I'm trying to get inside that character's head in the perspective, so that you're genuinely seeing the world through that character's eyes and how they feel about things and how they describe things, and so sometimes that shakes readers up a little bit because there's nothing omniscient about that perspective. It's not me, you know, saying these things, but if I'm in the perspective of a perpetrator or somebody else, I'm seeing the world through their eyes and letting the reader see the world through their eyes, and that can sometimes be an uncomfortable experience. So on the other hand, when you see the world through the eyes of a protagonist, someone like Frost or someone like Stride in the Stride novels, I think it really allows you to get inside their head and develop an intimate connection with them, and I think that's why readers feel, you know, strongly about my heroes is because of that tone and that voice that they bring, that you really get a sense of their depth of compassion and who they are. And I think it allows you to know them at a pretty intimate level.
Yeah, you do. And I think that's time for Crush to settle down eventually.
Well, we'll see. There will be things happening for Frost. I don't know if it will let him settle down, but you'll be interested in to see how things develop in the next Frost book in next year or so.
Uh-oh, poor Serena. She's in big trouble. I can feel it in my bones. And she's a tough character, but I don't like Maggie for him. No, sorry, you can't do that.
You don't like Maggie for Stride? Okay, well,
I like her, but not for Stride.
You'll certainly see some developments with Stride and Serena in Marathon. So, but I will give nothing away.
Oh, good, don't. So we just talked about first person, second person, whatever. Voice, let me just tell everybody that, like I said, Valentine's Day is coming up. And I have to tell you that my cab dispatcher, my dental hygienist, and there's about 10 people that are looking to see if I'm going to give Nightbird to them. And I would suggest you go to Amazon. You'll get it faster.
Yes, and it's a good price out there, too. So, yeah.
It's an excellent price. It's worth it. And you're not getting my copy, so too bad. you could also, I just finished... It took, and thank God the font was large. It was 600 pages. It was about Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and it was a really bloody, violent book, Assassins, Mike Bond. It took me a while to get into it, but when I sent the review, and I don't normally write like 1,700 words, but in order to get the point across of what he was trying to say, the publicist said that I did a great job, so that's all that really matters. He thinks I'm wonderful, and that's what's great. Like I said before, Lost Order, A Tramp Life, about young teenagers that run away from home and find their living as squatters and what happens to them. The book was really interesting. And Tanya Kappas, who writes Ghostly Reunion and Ghostly Mortality, she writes about Emily Raines, who runs a funeral home, but she sees the dead bodies that get murdered, and she has to help them cross over because she sees the betweeners. And they're hilarious. The book is hilarious. The books are hilarious. So, before we end, do you ever use, when you use flashbacks to create events, I know that you're doing it. How do you decide where to put the flashback so that the reader doesn't say, huh? Because I've said that a couple of times in a couple of books, like, wait a minute, where did this happen, and how come this is happening now?
Yeah, you have to be very careful about flashbacks because, you know, it can be a very useful tool to bring the reader back to a particularly emotional part of a character's path, and yet it also derails the forward movement of the narrative. And, you know, some readers really hate flashbacks because it kind of takes them out of the present. So you have to use it pretty judiciously and think through, you know, where you can use a flashback to really illuminate something about a character at the appropriate juncture in that character's life. So you have some sense of suddenly it makes sense why they're reacting in a particular way. And usually if I use flashbacks, most of the time it tends to deal with a particularly high drama, high stress moment in a person's life. And as a result, I think it makes the flashback inherently dramatic and interesting for the reader, as opposed to something that sort of, you know, jolts them out of the narrative and makes them go, oh yeah, keep, you know, get back to the pace. I want to make sure that the flashback is eliciting that same sense of drama and tension that the rest of the book does.
Are you bringing Frankie back too with Frost, or are you going to bring somebody else back?
Not in the next book. The next book is all Frost. Yes, and of course, you know, as you read The Nightbird, you realize that, you know, Frost has a very significant issue in his past in the death of his sister.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be safe to conclude that the second book focuses on what happened to Frost's sister, and perhaps not everything is as meets the eye.
This is true, and I can't wait to read it already. Now you got me going here. And I can't wait to read my hot hunk, Jonathan Stride. I mean, really. So,
there's one character we didn't talk about,
and that's Herb. Can we say anything about him
in
relationship to Frankie?
Herb will be back in the second book as well. Herb's just a mm-hmm. great San Francisco kind of character. He paints three-dimensional sidewalk portraits, and he's a good friend of Frost going back a lot of years, and Frost or Herb has sort of connections into the San Francisco street population that is often very useful for Frost. And that's the interesting thing about Frost, is that he doesn't hang out with a lot of cops. He's a little bit of an introvert, and he likes hanging out with people who aren't really connected to the police. And as a result, that gives me the chance to introduce some interesting other characters into the books.
Well, that is good. So before we end, where can everybody learn more about Brian Freeman? And like I said, Valentine's Day is just a week from Tuesday. Start collecting those books, put them in a big basket. And if it's for your husband, you can put some, you know, coolers, wine, whatever you want to put in it. And if it's for one of us, you know, you could put some flowers in a big basket. And I don't need chocolates. I don't need chocolate. So, you know, it's great. And you know what? For family members or whatever, it's a great present to give a book. And, of course, you know, St. Patrick's Day, we'll take presents, and Mother's Day, Father's Day. I mean, get started
there's
now.
There's no bad day to give someone a book.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
And people can find me pretty much everywhere online. They can go to my all-new website. It just came out a couple months ago. My website is bfreemanbooks.com, all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. It's all new, so go out there and check it out. And you can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/bfreemanfans. And you can find me on Twitter at bfreemanbooks and Instagram at bfreemanbooks. So everywhere you look, you'll find me online.
This is true. And I'm very honored that someone by the name of Marcia Freeman is following me also.
Yes, you can find my wife on Facebook as well. She's got a blog called The Author's Wife, and she kind of talks about the humorous side of the book business and all the crazy things that happen when you go out on the road and do events all around the country. So look for facebook.com/theauthorswife, all one word, and go like Marcia's page and follow along with her. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do. I write on everybody's page. Not everybody's page. I only write nice things, though. I only post my book reviews, and I don't write anything negative because it's not my place to pan a book. So if I don't like something, I won't review it. I'll just write a summary, and I won't post it on Amazon. Because I've read a lot of reviews, and I'm saying some of them, oh, this book was horrible. That's not a review. That's your opinion. And I think Amazon needs to sort out the difference between a reviewer like myself and somebody that's writing an opinion that didn't read the book or just says, oh, I hate this book. When I opened it up, I couldn't stand it. But that won't happen with Brian Freeman's book.
That's a really good perspective. I mean, you know, because I've been very sensitive to that ever since I became a writer. Because, I mean, yeah, these are authors are people. And you know, when people kind of take gratuitous shots at you, it certainly doesn't make you feel good. But, you know, it's made me sensitive that, you know what, just because something is not to your taste doesn't mean it's not going to be to someone else's taste. And that's true whether it's a book, a movie, a restaurant, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people just have different takes on what they're looking for from these experiences.
This is true, but they don't have that problem with your book, because if they don't like it, they're going to answer to me. Forget it. Don't worry about that. So I want to thank you so much. The sun is still shining, and I'm not looking forward to what the rest of my day is going to bring, but you never know. Maybe I'll get lucky, and it won't be anything wrong. Who knows? But thank you so much. And when you know your schedule, just let me know, and you know I'm going to give you
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Fran.
Thank you so much, Brian. Everybody, have a great day. Go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble. It's not too far away from you. And buy a couple of hundred books because, you know, authors are great. Their words are fantastic. And if you're tired and you don't feel well, sit in front of a fireplace and read a book. Okay, everybody, have a nice day and bye.